Welcome. This is the Energy Utilities, Technology, and Communications Committee meeting. And we don't have a quorum, but I know you have an author's amendment. We can vote on that when we have a quorum. But I think it would be a good idea for us to start anyways. And we will be starting with Senator Scott Dibble and Senate File 549.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Senate File 549 is it's kind of the first attempt for the legislature in the state of Minnesota to start addressing another major aspect of climate change. As we've set forth in our recent policy goals as a state and as a legislature, you're well aware, of course, Madam Chair and members of the Climate Change Action Group or Climate Change Advisory Group that was tasked with taking a look at all of the activities and all the sectors and all of the things that we do in Minnesota that might contribute to global greenhouse gas emissions in Minnesota. And we've certainly spent a lot of time in this committee talking a lot about the utility
Senator
sector.
Dibble, turn that microphone just a little bit.
Sure, how's that?
To you.
Is that better?
Yes.
All right. So we spent a lot of time and we've taken a lot of policy action on trying to address greenhouse gas emissions and carbon that come from the energy sector, electrical sector. And we know from extensive conversation and testimony and study and consideration that in Minnesota about 35% of our greenhouse gas emissions come from that sector. The other major contributor to greenhouse gas emissions to our global warming situation is the transportation sector, about 24%. And then it goes down from there, ag activities, industrial activities, the fuel they use in industrial activities, et cetera. The MCAG recommended 46 policy actions. Significant attention was paid to the transportation sector and some of the things that we can do within that realm. And they were a wise group of folks who understood that transportation isn't just about transportation, about, you know, it's not an activity unto itself. It's about people going places to do things. And, of course, that involves destinations, activities, people going to their job, people going home, people going shopping, you name it. And it's abundantly obvious that if, in fact, all of those activities are in closer proximity to one another, there's less use of automobiles. It supports more and greater and better use of transit, and likewise, transit can support the kind of development that, frankly, our demographic, our aging demographics are looking for. The people in Minnesota, as they're getting older, are looking for ways of moving around the community more easily. And the market itself is looking to make those changes. And right now we have a lot of policies in place that really support the kind of development that we see, particularly in the metropolitan area. A lot of sprawl, a lot of spread out, a lot of roads, a lot of denying people the choices that they need to make in their lives to make a different kinds of transportation decisions. Some of the policies that we talk about in that realm include zoning, property taxes, home ownership policies, fuel subsidies, roadway construction, finance policy. Many others interact to create the kind of development we have. The Center for Transportation Studies at the University of Minnesota also turned in a study. It was commissioned by the legislature. And they found some very compelling facts, and they support very strongly the recommendations of the Climate Change Action Group. And I'll just read, and most of you, I hope, have seen this study, and if you haven't, I can make that available to you if you're interested, or you can go find it on the website. And it really takes a look at the transportation sector and ways that the transportation sector can make changes to contribute to our greenhouse gas emission reduction goals, the goals that we have by 2015, 2025, and 2050, ultimately reducing them to 2005 levels by 2050, 80% reduction. And the key findings are that the transportation sector can nearly meet its own share of the of Minnesota's greenhouse gas emission goals in 2015 and can exceed them in 2025 using a combination of strategies targeted to reduce fuel consumption, vehicle miles traveled, and fuel carbon content. We've had a little discussion about that in this committee as well. And it says comprehensive action is needed sooner, not later. Very potent, very powerful findings. We can do what we need to do. We can do it sooner rather than later. And the transportation sector can make its total contribution to the reductions that we're after. With that, Madam Chair, those introductory comments, I thought I would do a quick walkthrough of the bill, and then we'll have our testifiers also share with you why this is such a great idea. The bill has changed a little bit, so bear with me as I try to track the sections that I'm describing. We start off, of course, with findings, which we're so fond of in the Senate. And in the first section that has a policy action, Section 2, which finds that wetlands have value for their carbon sequestration properties in addition to all the other reasons why they're so important. So it places some value for those properties on wetlands, which is a great benefit, particularly to those areas that contain a lot of wetlands. Section 3 creates grants to local communities through the Environmental Quality Board for those communities that are looking to change their land use policies and their zoning policies. This has to do with communities. This bill is primarily focused and targeted towards the metropolitan area and the comprehensive planning and the land use activities that they do. This has statewide application, though, if communities of their own initiative on a voluntary basis want to take a look at zoning changes, this provides some financial support for that purpose. Section 4 has to do with how we, Section 4 and Section 5, I should say, have to do with all the criteria and decisions we make around siting new schools. Right now, the criteria that we have in place really force schools to be built on large campus footprints, in many cases forces them kind of out of town, to the edges of town, to places where they can amass that kind of acreage. And it also disincents schools from significant rehab. If the value of the school rehab approaches 60% of that school, then a new school has to be built. So, again, creating lots of environmental consequence by forcing new construction when maybe renovation might make more sense. And there's no bonus given in the criteria that the commissioner considers for siting schools near pedestrian, bike, other sorts of transportation facilities, or near places where the school can maximize already in-place investments like parks, other public facilities, and the like. So it kind of reorders a little bit how we site schools, particularly when it comes to new construction or significant rehab. Of course, we all know that it has its own transportation consequence. But it also, once you've taken a school and taken it out of town, put it out in a farm field way at the edge of town, then all kinds of development grows up around there as well. So kind of self-defeating if we're trying to provide for a different future. Section 6 is where we start getting into directly into some policy levers that relate to transportation more directly. And it creates a goal within the Minnesota Department of Transportation of reducing vehicle miles traveled. And that is designed to allow MnDOT to more explicitly consider how we better and more efficiently use our overall transportation system rather than just accommodating cars that want to travel faster. Places this particular goal alongside all the goals that we're familiar with in MnDOT, like safety, congestion, maintenance, et cetera. Section 7 is a conforming change. Section 8 is where we get into some of the metropolitan area policy tools. We place within the metropolitan area development guidelines consideration of all of the issues that you might expect around land use, parks, open space, highways, transit facilities, but also consideration of greenhouse gas reduction in our development, overall development guiding language. in Section 9, similar to the MnDOT criteria around vehicle miles traveled. This really recognizes that Metropolitan Council has a unique role in guiding land use plans and the corresponding regional investments we make in transportation and sewer services, and it asks that the Met Council take a look at vehicle miles traveled and reducing those as a policy. In Section 10, we have the Livable Communities Fund, which I think most, particularly the metropolitan area, most legislators are familiar with, and those are matching funds that we make available to communities in the metropolitan area that have a development proposal in hand of the kind and criteria that we set forth in these fund guidelines, intensifying land use, mixed use development, proximity to transit and the like. And it places among those criteria the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and reductions in VMTs, vehicle miles traveled. We'll refer to that term a lot, VMT, vehicle miles traveled. Moving on, Section 11. This is where we get into land use planning and comprehensive plans. And in this, what we ask is that the comprehensive plans that we undertake that are updated every 10 years in the metropolitan area, which we're actually right now in the midst of updating and finalizing, that we don't wait another 10 years, but that we within a few years, by 2013, we take a look at the comprehensive plans in the metropolitan area and establish some of these vehicle miles traveled reduction goals within that land use planning that we do. And that follows through to the Met Council's review and approval and adoption of those comprehensive plans. It all kind of builds up to an overarching land use plan that the Metropolitan Council ultimately has review and final approval authority over. In Section 12, we ask the University of Minnesota Center for Transportation Studies to undertake a study and develop a model that local governments can use along with the Metropolitan Council to identify those best strategies to reduce vehicle miles traveled and reduce carbon emissions. And that is designed to really develop as much technical expertise and capacity so that this comp plan, the kind of intermediate update that we're asking for, that's going to be somewhat of an effort on the part of local communities and the Met Council, that some of that be taken on by the University of Minnesota so that they're not reinventing the wheel, and they're not just doing this from scratch all on their own, in the many municipalities that we have in the metropolitan area. It's an attempt to share some of the best strategies, develop some capacity, some technical expertise, and some consulting. And we pay for that through the local or the regional levy that we make for livable communities. And finally, it's an open appropriation also from the Livable Communities Fund in order to help with some of the grants that we talked about earlier to local communities. While we're on the subject of comprehensive planning, I know that the Association of Metropolitan Counties as well as the League of Minnesota Cities have concern about cities being asked to revise their comprehensive plans before the next 10-year cycle makes them due, this intermediate basis. And we're working together on addressing that particular issue. I will, I've committed to them as we move on to the next committees to figure out how to make that as least burdensome as possible and, find the resources and the technical expertise that they have. I do believe that this provides a significant policy lever for them to look at development, future development, in a way that's much more holistic, that responds to changing demographics, that allows better use of in-place infrastructure so that, much larger issues of fiscal concern can be more readily addressed through land use planning. With that, I can stand for questions, Madam Chair, or we can go to our witnesses.
Well, first, we have a quorum, so you can move your A2 amendment. Senator Dibble moves the A2 amendment
to
put the bill in the shape that the author desires.
And that was an amendment drafted with the help of counsel, Mr. Fuller, shape up the bill and some, some smallish technical changes. So okay. It has to do with the appropriation and some grammatical stuff.
Any questions? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. So would you prefer to take questions now or after your testimony?
Why don't we have testimony first? Maybe that'll answer the questions.
Okay.
And there won't be any questions when we're done. Okay. So we have Jay Drake Hamilton with Fresh Energy, also served on the MCAG, and share some thoughts with you.
Ms. Hamilton.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you so much for taking testimony on this vital bill today. My name is Jay Drake Hamilton. I serve as Science Policy Director. I manage the Global Warming Solutions Program for the Minnesota-based firm Fresh Energy. We're a private nonprofit. We have existed since 1990, and we were formed to help move the state of Minnesota and our region to an energy economy that will help build healthier economies around the region, a healthier environment, and move us to energy independence. And Fresh Energy strongly supports passage of Senate File 549. We believe it's a vital component of helping the state meet the goals in the state's Next Generation Energy Act. And as many of you know, in May 2007, the legislature passed that into law, the Next Generation Energy Act, after a lot of discussion in a number of committees. And the legislature and governor were recognizing the many implications that global warming may have right here in Minnesota on our natural resources-based economy, and the quality of life, especially the quality of future life in Minnesota. And appropriately, the state set science-based reduction goals from a 2005 baseline, 15% across the economy by 2015, at least 30% across the economy by 2025, and at least 80% by 2050. The law builds on Minnesota's nation-leading energy policies that are bringing us more renewable energy, more energy savings, both of which lower carbon dioxide emissions. So we know that we're building from the 25% renewable energy requirement, the 1.5% annual savings from natural gas and electric utilities by adding the 30% reduction in greenhouse gases. At about the same time, Governor Pawlenty, working closely with the Department of Commerce and Pollution Control Agency and other state agencies, procured the services of the Center for Climate Strategies, and the governor's office handpicked the members of a 56-member advisory group that we have come to know as either the governor's climate change advisory group or the MCAG. And those represented a wide range of industries and businesses, small and large, throughout the state, many organizations, many citizen interests. The sectors represented many of the companies that specialize in energy, manufacturing of all sorts of things, agriculture, mining, forestry, tourism, waste, healthcare, NGOs like Fresh Energy, academia, and state and local government. And I was one of those representatives. The governor in spring of 2007, when he welcomed us to the first meeting of the group, gave us a letter that said, and I want to quote from it, "The purpose of the MCAG is to identify, evaluate, and recommend to me and the Minnesota legislature a range of actions that, consistent with the state's need for economic vitality, will substantially reduce Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions." So that was our charge. A few months later that year, the world's leading scientific authorities on climate change, which are known as the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, put together by the World Meteorological Organization and the United Nations, came out with their latest assessment report of the state of the science. And I want to quote from that. They said, "Warming of the climate system is unequivocal, as is now evident from observations of increases in global average air and ocean temperatures, widespread melting of snow and ice, and rising global average sea level." Unequivocal. Now, that was a word that I don't use too much in my daily life. I don't use it at all. So I had to go to the dictionary to make sure to look up what that meant, because I know that when scientists choose a word for a published report, they choose it very carefully. And this was driven home to me just this past summer when one of the authors of that report, Dr. Susan Solomon, was at the University of Minnesota, St. Paul, talking about the development of that report. And she said they deliberately chose that word unequivocal because it really captured what they wanted to convey. And unequivocal means unambiguous, clear, having only one possible meaning or interpretation. In other words, there was no other set of conclusions they could reach from the observations all over the world of increasing temperature than that the temperature, in fact, is increasing. Now I'm going to take you forward to this last week in Chicago, where the American Association for the Advancement of Science, the AAAS that publishes Science Magazine, was having their annual meeting. And the founding director of the Carnegie Institution at Stanford University, Christopher Field, was widely quoted in the media because of a report that he made to that group. Climate change is coming much harder, much faster than we predicted. We now know that without effective action, climate change is going to be larger and more difficult to deal with than we had thought. We are basically looking at a future climate that's beyond anything we've seriously considered in climate model simulations. And it turns out that, according to the oceanographers who are hard at work at this, most of the reason is that the oceans, which have been inadvertently doing human beings a great service by absorbing much of the carbon dioxide, are now reaching capacity. And so more of the carbon dioxide is going to stay right in our atmosphere. So it's becoming especially clear that this is a serious and urgent problem. We also know that we have a serious and urgent economic problem. So we need to find a way to reinvigorate Minnesota's economy, grow our energy security, and take the science-based action needed to slow, stop, and start reversing the problem of global warming. We know we need to take our emissions by law from the 2005 baseline of almost 157 million metric tons. We need to cut that by at least 30% by 2025. What the MCAG recommended unanimously after a year of deliberation and study and analysis on this issue of how you find and develop more attractive options for Minnesotans to get around and reduce global warming pollution was a suite of measures that you'll hear about from a later testifier that all reduce vehicle miles traveled, improved land use planning, better development strategies, expanding transit, bicycle, pedestrian infrastructure, and the workplace tools that will encourage carpooling, transit ridership, bicycling to work. All of those had unanimous support, and they all would achieve carbon reductions at no net cost, net savings to large net savings for Minnesota. So as we move forward in taking on our responsibility for global warming pollution, Fresh Energy believes that we need to take this vital action. This is a vital component of moving us toward the Next Generation Energy Act global warming reduction goals. Thank you.
Okay.
Madam Chair, we have Catherine DeCray, who is a student at Augsburg.
Catherine DeCray?
DeCray, yeah. Thank you for your time. My name is Kathy DeCray, and I come from Bemidji, Minnesota, to study at Augsburg College. Even though this is only my first year at college, I've already started to think about where I want to settle after school. Some of the things I will consider are transit options, clean environment, and a sensible layout. If any of you have been to Bemidji, you may know that the town is very scattered and has extremely limited transportation options. These limitations were highlighted when I had to get a job last year to save money for college. Since public transportation was out of the question, I had no choice but to drive. Every day, I drove 20 minutes to get there and back. For a while, it worked, but eventually, with rising prices, I realized I wasn't making enough to cover gas and car payments while being able to save money for school. When I am in these situations, I feel trapped. When I graduate, I want to make sure to live somewhere that isn't so spread out, that doesn't take half my paycheck to get to work, and where I don't have to look at the weather reports to see if the air is safe to breathe that day. By supporting this bill, you can ensure that this is a Minnesota that will be here for me, my children, and my grandchildren. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, we have, let's call it the next two testifiers, Will Schroer, who was a consultant to the Climate Change Advisory Group, and Richard Graves, who is an architect with Perkins and Will, and a member of the U.S. Green Building Council.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Will Schroer. As Senator Dibble says, I was a consultant to the Governor's Commission and specifically facilitated the transportation and land use portion of that process. The process was broken into groups along the lines of different sectors of the economy, so each group could focus on a specific sector. There was an agriculture and forestry sector, a buildings sector, everybody that basically uses power, a power generation sector, so energy supply. There was a cross-cutting sector, so potential public outreach efforts that would cover all sectors and talk about the need and potential response. And then a transportation and land use sector to focus specifically on the 24% of Minnesota's greenhouse gas emissions that come from transportation and, as Senator Dibble pointed out, the need not just to transport things for their own sake, but to get from one place to another, and hence, as part of that, land use. Governor's Commission set up a very formalized process. All sectors followed the same process. J. Drake Hamilton pointed out, the stakeholders were picked by the governor to represent a cross-section of stakeholders in Minnesota's future. Electeds from across the state, government staff that brought expertise to the table, citizens and businesses who would both be affected by the specific actions in that sector and, of course, would be affected by the resulting changes in the climate and the economy that Ms. Hamilton pointed out. My job was to facilitate this process. All the facilitators were given the charge of facilitating, not driving the process. All the stakeholders had the same charge, which was read to you, which was to make recommendations to the governor and to the legislature about how to reach the goals that were that the governor laid out for the stakeholders. I can tell you that it was a learning process for everybody, particularly in transportation and land use. We had an interesting situation. I would sometimes look longingly at my colleagues in energy supply, who had worked together on power plant and biofuels issues seemingly for a long time together, and they knew each other, and they knew the lingo, and they knew basically what the policy challenges were and could kind of get down to business. On transportation and land use, we had stakeholders from three areas which had so far not really worked that closely together. There's the technology folks working on making vehicles much more efficient. There are the fuels folks, particularly on the biofuel side, which are working to lower the carbon contents of fuels. And then there are transportation system and land use folks, which are focusing on making development patterns more efficient and then making the system, whatever is being driven on it, more efficient. And those folks have some interchange up till now, but they're going to work a lot more closely together in the future. I can promise you that. And for some of them, it was the first time to meet each other during this process. And I can speak for myself. I learned a lot from that process, and I think I can speak for the others when I say that they did as well. In any case, we had a very interesting year-long process, and I think quite friendly for the most part, although there was the occasional, as they say in the press, full and frank discussion. The governor charged us not to seek unanimity if we couldn't get to it, but to try and work out differences if at all possible. And as Ms. Hamilton suggested to you, we were able to come back to the full governor's task force. That is, each of the sectoral committees came back and made recommendations to the full task force, which were then voted on by everybody, whether they worked on that task force or not. And all of our recommendations passed the full task force, almost all of them unanimously. We had a couple of supermajorities, which meant that out of the 50 or so folks on the advisory group, there were two or three objections. And then there was one just simple majority, which was the California Clean Car Standards, which we're not going to talk about here today. Not because it's not interesting and important, but that's just not the subject of today's testimony. What I'd like to draw to your attention as it relates to the legislation that's in front of you is we considered three sets of potential sources of reductions. The first is a very popular technology-oriented or fuel-oriented option, which is that we reduce the greenhouse gas emissions from the actual burning of fuel, whether that's fossil fuel or biofuels or, you know, electricity from hydropower, what have you. So that's one option, and as you see, that was unanimously adopted. We reduced the emissions through simple from technology, the engines. That's TLU Area 3 that you see in front of you here, and I think in some of your handouts. So that's the technology side. And then that got us about two-thirds of the way to where we needed to be, and so we had to look very hard at TLU Area 1, reducing vehicle miles traveled. And my main message to you is, as the findings of the MCAG relate to the legislation in front of you, is that you cannot, that is, we, the state, cannot reach the goals that we have set for ourselves without adopting a different way of doing planning for land use as it relates to our transportation system. And that was a message that resonated persuasively with the broader, with first the experts on our stakeholder group and then the broader set of the governor's advisory committee. As you see, most of those recommendations passed unanimously and all the others passed with supermajorities. There was in no way any of the disagreement that characterized the discussions around, say, the California Clean Car Standards. So the situation, I think, was persuasive to the folks that the governor called together, and we now bring those findings to you for your consideration. The bottom line with TLU 1 was that the various strategies taken together not only needed to, but in fact could, the good news for you today, could reduce statewide per capita VMT miles from yesterday's 2005 levels 15% by 2025. There was quite a bit of discussion in the group about whether that was that there was no discussion about whether that was necessary. Well, I can't say no discussion. There was some discussion, but it was pretty clear to people that it was necessary. Then the discussion focused on, was it doable? And in the end, we decided that it was, in fact, doable with the tools that we had available to us today. I'm not going to read this to you. It's available to you in the governor's advisory committee report. I will highlight for you the policy design that is included in that report. There are specific recommendations for the Twin Cities metro area, which obviously has some special situations. There are suggestions, stronger than suggestions, recommendations for Greater Minnesota. So we kind of broke those two situations out. The timing, just like the climate scientists, our view of the timing was, I think, close to unequivocal, that to achieve these goals, policy implementation really needed to start immediately. We don't have the time to wait for the next set of comprehensive plan updates, and that's just really the bottom line. And then there were a set of statewide policy recommendations as well that would apply everywhere. As I suggested, we spent a great deal of time both in the Transportation and Land Use Focus Committee and then in the broader advisory group talking about whether we could get these results. In the end, as you see, everyone agreed that we could. We did that in part by looking at Minnesota's situation. We also looked at others. What are they doing, other states, other large metro areas? They're doing it. The tools to do this are in place and are being used by people today. They're in place at state levels, certainly not all state levels. Minnesota continues to be a leader in this area. We need state action, which is why Senator Dibble and we are here today. We also need action at the Met Council and at the level of the other municipalities around the state. But the state, I think, really needs to lead, and that was the message of the MCAG to you today. Finally, I don't know if you're all sick of reading about the stimulus yet. I understand that the president is signing it or has already signed it in Denver today. Minnesota is going to get quite a bit of money out of the stimulus package. Going into that would far exhaust the time, which I think I've already used up anyway. So I'm just going to leave you with the suggestion that there is money available today, which was not available when the MCAG drew these conclusions. And so, if anything, I think the situation today is more optimistic than it was when the MCAG voted unanimously to forward these recommendations to the governor. The main pushback, and I'm just going to take one more minute of your time, that we get on the doability of some of these goals is on the pace of land use change. And I just want to throw one piece of data to you here today. There's no question that achieving these goals is going to require that more people, more people and businesses choose to live in downtown and currently developed areas. Now, how we go about doing that is that doesn't mean we require people to do it. It just means that that needs to be the outcome in the end. I thought this was a pretty interesting chart about the central city share of new residential construction in a variety of cities around the country, some of which are growing and some of which are, frankly, not growing, like Philadelphia. And this was, you know, this was before anyone was talking about requiring that growth go one place or another. What you see is that people are making the decision based on their own calculation of what's good for them, not unlike the I thought, very well put statement from the Augsburg student here, that what they want out of their own life is to live in different places. And a good chunk of the committee's recommendations to you is that the planning needs to, if anything, get out of the way of the market so that people can live where they want to live. And when that's done, then you see remarkable changes, very fast changes, in how the market provides for central city residential construction. So I thought that was a very optimistic set of data. And we've all had the experience of maybe driving to Bemidji and driving past a cornfield one year and the next year, it's been developed. So I think it's not the case that land use changes slowly. Land use can change very, very quickly. And the good news is that with the help of the legislation that's in front of you, I think the state and its municipalities can get in front of that in a very productive way. Finally, most of us here, I guess, probably have had the experience of discovering that it's easier to steer a moving canoe, and what we have here is a rapidly moving canoe. So I hope that you'll help steer it in the right direction and be happy to take questions at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Senator
Dibble. Madam Chair, we have two folks from the U.S. Green Building Council, Richard Graves, who's also an architect here in town at Perkins and Will, and Sherry Brzezinka is visiting us from the U.S. GBC.
Is this the one that's – this one? No? Okay. I'll let you pull up the right one here.
Madam Chair, Senators, thank you for the opportunity to testify on this issue. My name is Richard Graves. I'm a practicing architect with the firm of Perkins and Will. We have about 100 people in downtown Minneapolis. I'm also a national board member of the U.S. Green Building Council.
And my name is Sherry Brzezinka. I'm the executive director of the Mississippi Headwaters chapter of the U.S. Green Building Council, which is here in Minnesota. So Richard and I represent the 500-plus members of the U.S. Green Building Council that are here in Minnesota. The U.S. Green Building Council is a nonprofit organization that works towards enhancing sustainable communities, and it consists nationally of over 16,000 organizations currently. The SF-549 bill is quite in alignment with USGBC's vision and mission. So we can bring some examples today of sustainable neighborhoods and some of the benefits created by those.
And since 1999 through
Mr. Graves.
Sorry?
No, I'm just announcing your name for the recorder.
Oh, okay, thank you. Since 1999, the U.S. Green Building Council has been promoting and working on metrics for green buildings through the LEED rating system. And in 2005, we'll talk about a new rating system, LEED for Neighborhood Development, where we start to expand our view and look at the sustainability of buildings beyond just the building itself into communities. And the reason that's important can be seen in this slide that shows the different segments that contribute to CO2 emissions from fossil fuel combustion traditionally the LEED rating system, and our focus were on the 43% contribution of the building sector. However, when we think about the broader impacts of emissions from the manufacture of building materials and products, the transportation of construction and demolition materials, and the passenger and freight transportation associated with urban sprawl, the result is an even larger footprint for the building sector, reaching into the transportation sector and also the industrial sector. And any effective climate change strategy needs to consider all these sectors associated with building construction, their use and location. Both of these images and slides are from a Pew Center for Global Climate Change report on the impacts of the building sector. Also, in their study, they noted that if you take the typical detached house, 53% of its ecological footprint has to do with the type of house, how energy efficient it is, how much insulation it has. 44% of the ecological footprint has to do with the associated travel impacts of the distance of that house from place of work, from services, and other impacts. And then 3% is associated with the need for municipal infrastructure to connect that house to sewer, water, energy. Studies have shown that well-planned compact growth consumes 45% less land, costs 25% less for roads, 20% less for utilities, and 5% less for schools than does sprawling growth. And then one study, and then you can see the results of that study in this slide, created a direct relationship between the density of residential areas and the impact on CO2 emissions per household. So if you look at the top of the slide, right around 33 pounds per year of CO2 emissions would be kind of the typical suburban development at 3 households per acre. Just down from there, the next kind of dot on the slide would be a 6 household per acre residential development. That would be similar to, say, the McAllister Groveland neighborhood in St. Paul. Down from there would be 10 household units per acre. That's the threshold where buses and transit can run on a schedule of 10 to 15 minutes per bus, which in surveys seems to be a convenient schedule to have readily access to transit. And then at 20 households per acre, which would be similar to the Crocus Hill neighborhood of St. Paul. And you can see as the density of the residential neighborhood goes up, the CO2 emissions per household come way down, especially when you get towards a threshold of about 20 households per acre. And it's a reduction of about 40%, mostly from the travel-related impacts. And it doesn't necessarily, I think another thing to point out for design as an architect, that's an average residential density. It doesn't all have to be at 20 households per acre. Apartment buildings. You could have a mix of single-family residential, duplex, townhouses, and high-rises, and I'll show you an example of that.
So the LEED rating systems developed,
Ms. Brzezinka,
by the U.S. Green Building Council have traditionally had a focus on the impacts of transportation through the sustainable sites, through the promotion of density, and through the use of alternative transportations. Now with the LEED for Neighborhood rating system, USGBC is taking this to the next level with developing a rating system that's solely around neighborhoods.
And to reduce vehicle miles travel, it's not just about density and residential density. And the Neighborhood Development rating system creates metrics to look at other factors that contribute to lowering vehicle miles traveled, like transit access, walkable communities, bike networks, the proximity of housing to jobs, the proximity of schools to housing. Those are all contained within the SMART location and linkage areas. And then in terms of neighborhood pattern and design, diverse housing types, both in size to accommodate different periods of people's lives, when they have kids, when they don't have kids, so you have different units available, different price structures, so that you have affordable housing with housing for higher income, so you reduce travel to for service workers and other workers to get to their jobs. And in over since 2005, this rating system has been piloted with 205 projects around the country, and some of the benefits you can see on this slide. The average population density for a LEED for Neighborhood Development project is over 5,000 people per square mile, which is about double the U.S. average. The results are the average transit commute share is about 11.7% for LEED for Neighborhood pilot projects, compared to almost about 6.5% for all urban areas and 4.7% for all zip codes in the U.S. And the same increase is shown with walk and bike commute share. And all those increased shares for transit commuting, walking and biking contribute toward CO2 savings.
So just an example.
Ms. Brzezinka.
We know that green neighborhoods have green buildings in them and that those buildings promote density. They're energy efficient and with focus on mixed incomes, homes available for all incomes. And here's one example that shows a few statistics of the benefits of that. We also know that those green homes are near services, some of which can be schools, and that schools can be green also. We know that green schools not only promote energy and savings and water cost savings, but they also impact the health and well-being of the students as well as the staff and the faculty that guide those students. In fact, the first LEED certified building in Minnesota was a school, and that was Westwood Elementary School in Zimmerman, Minnesota. And you can see some of the positive impacts from that LEED school.
No, actually, we can't see the screen from here. So it would be helpful if you could make copies of your slides and present them to the committee later.
You should have copies of your slides, of our slides, in front of you.
It's in this one.
Okay, thank you.
Also, at Perkins and Will, we design buildings and communities all around the country and all around North America, including this project in Victoria, British Columbia, which is the first registered LEED for New Development project in North America. It's called Dockside Green. It's a mixed-use development on a 16-acre former brownfield site along the waterfront in Victoria. Of note, the first building was just completed, called Synergy, that achieved LEED Platinum status, the highest number of points ever received by a LEED project. And even in this housing economy, the project is still going on, still being built, still leasing up all of its units when other projects around it are not succeeding. So I think it's a sign of the attraction for these types of projects that show savings benefits to the occupants for their utility bills. Project uses 50 to 52% less energy than a typical project. It's also affordable. It has an affordable housing component to it. So it has a mix of unit types and a mix of price points that we talked about before. And you can see that it's a good example of it doesn't have to be uniform density to achieve dense numbers. You can have a mix of residential towers with retail and mixed service on the bottom and townhouses and other units to spread the density and create variation and also create open space to have connection to natural areas. This project actually doesn't have a traditional stormwater system. It uses the streams and water courses that you see in the photo on the top right as its stormwater management system that's more in tune with nature and creates parkland for the occupants. And finally, at Perkins & Will, at our Minneapolis office, we not only design sustainable projects, but we've been working really hard to look at our operations, energy used in our office, but also our commute share and our transit impact for our employees. And we studied in our office with an employee survey of how our employees get to work. And this and the results are shown on this slide, where we have over about 47% of our employees in downtown Minneapolis take transit to work. Compared to the Twin Cities average of about 4.6%. And significantly, only 37% drive a car by themselves to work, which is about half the Twin Cities average. And I think that's a sign of a number of things. Our staff, we have a quite young staff whose choices are driven by setting priorities for sustainability and community connection and things like that. So I think this is also a sign of things to come and increased demand for projects like Dockside that I just showed, that more and more as that segment of the population makes housing choices and locates themselves in the metro area, they're going to pick for locations with good access to transit, walkable communities, and close to services.
So just to conclude, green neighborhoods are great places to live as well as a terrific opportunity to combat climate change. They reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 20 to 40% or more per person. And green neighborhoods are compact, livable, mixed-use communities with green spaces, green infrastructure, and often green buildings. Other design elements encourage social connections between residents and others, as well as many other benefits.
And those benefits include better health. Residents are more likely to be healthier than the average North American because they do not drive as much in order to live, raise a family, work, shop, play, and go to school. It creates economic opportunity. Green neighborhoods often have more successful businesses and cost less for local government to service. They also cost less for our employees with that benefit of taking transit. It costs less for them to commute to their workplace. And then they're diverse. Green neighborhoods have a greater range of housing and businesses supporting people of all walks of life, from families to seniors and everyone in between. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, with your indulgence, we have John Bailey, who's helping to lead this effort. He works with Thousand Friends of Minnesota. He'll do some wrap-up.
Okay, Mr. Bailey.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I know you've heard a lot over the last hour, so I'll be very brief and bring up a couple new points that other speakers haven't noted. First of all, I am with Thousand Friends of Minnesota. We're a statewide membership organization promoting thriving cities, towns, and suburbs surrounded by clean rivers, lakes, and streams. This is also an initiative, I should note, of the Minnesota Environmental Partnership. That's a coalition of over 80 environmental organizations represented all around the state. Let me begin just by noting this, which I realize that you all can't read very well, I assume. This sign right here, that's the U.S. Conference of Mayors has a climate protection agreement that mayors all around the country signed. And there's been 41 mayors all around Minnesota, which we should be very proud of. It's one of the highest numbers of mayors that have signed this climate protection agreement. The top, there's about, I think, 7-8 recommendations as part of that agreement. The top three align directly with our bill. And their policies, all these mayors agree to do this, to implement policies that support land use changes and transportation investments that reduce the number and length of vehicle trips by promoting greater transportation and housing choices. And so that's what this map was just meant to show you where all those cities are located all around the state and show there's really a lot of interest from local officials in Minnesota on achieving climate change goals and energy security goals as well. So with that, let me just go into a little bit of the framing of this bill and bring up some other points. Minnesota is projected to add 1.3 million new people by 2030. And that's really, I think, the most important frame for our bill. It's the new growth that is coming. This is a very pro-growth bill. We think that population movement coming to Minnesota is really key to the economic success of the state. These people, many of whom are going to be our kids and our grandchildren, of course, are going to be our next generation's entrepreneurs, business leaders, and cultural pioneers. What we don't want to do is add that amount of people based on last century's model of cheap energy, because that's gone. We know the era of cheap gas is waning, but less well-known is how the demographics of the state are changing as well. Like the rest of the country, the senior population is the fastest-growing segment of the population. Demographers refer to this as the silver tsunami that's coming. Perhaps a bit cheeky, but I think it's a good expression. By 2020, there will be more people over 65 in Minnesota than in K-12 education. We've never had a stat like that before that's coming. Additionally, besides that, families are having fewer children, younger people are staying single longer, and a growing number of households are children choosing not to have children at all. To put this in perspective, in 1960, just about 50% of households were two parents with children, and now that's only 23% of households. I mention all this because this change in demographics is shifting consumer preferences towards communities where people have greater choices in where they live and how they move around. And this is the important point. This is where we can have a win-win, because by meeting that market demand, we can also take an important step towards lowering greenhouse gas emissions and lowering our reliance on foreign oil. The good news is that changes in land use don't require technological breakthroughs or massive infrastructure investments, and they can result in big cost savings. A recent national study by the Urban Land Institute, which is a real estate research organization, suggests that modest changes in land use, mixing uses, pedestrian-friendly design, more compact development, could reduce driving by as much as 20% to 40%. And this is because, as common sense would suggest, when people live in neighborhoods where cars are not the only transportation options, they drive a third fewer miles in those neighborhoods where driving is the only way to get around. So you've heard a lot about global warming. We mentioned a couple other benefits in this kind of legislation besides that and my testimony. First, public infrastructure cost savings. More compact communities cost the public sector far less in the long term than more spread out communities. According to a Metropolitan Council study, a more compact development form, which would give people the opportunity to walk more, rely more on transit, and generally drive shorter distances, could save $3 billion in infrastructure costs over 20 years. Personal transportation costs. This is intuitive, but it bears repeating when we think of our current economic condition. Transportation has steadily been grabbing a larger share of household budgets. It is now the second largest expense behind only a mortgage. This burden is far greater in communities with little transportation choice and would only be exacerbated by rising fuel prices. This is why most people that deal in workforce housing recognize that access to transportation is integral to any meaningful definition of affordability. Finally, the other environmental benefits, which were legion, we won't go into today, but I had the real pleasure of serving on a committee for the statewide conservation and preservation plan that was funded by the LCCMR and just released a report last summer, I believe it was. This was big picture, big look. Let's look 50 years into the future. What are the main drivers of environmental damage in the state of Minnesota, and what can we do to affect that change? Again, in the executive summary, one of the top recommendations was to support better, more conservation, community-based planning, and also to achieve a per capita reduction in vehicle miles traveled over time. So we're studying this issue a lot, spending a lot of money through MCAG, the CTS study, the conservation plan. We're all coming up to the same solution every time. We have to provide people with more choices if we're going to provide better environmental benefits and achieve our greenhouse gas reduction goals. And I'll end with a stat that some people find frightening, but I actually find very, very hopeful. 50% of the development on the ground by 2050 is going to be built between now and then. This provides an enormous opportunity for us to rethink the public and private costs and benefits of our transportation investments and land use policies. What this bill does is set the policy framework moving forward that is informed by the emerging new realities of rising and erratic energy prices, global warming, and changing demographics and shifting consumer preferences. Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That concludes our testimony, and happy to stand for questions or other folks who want to talk about why this is such a great idea. Let me invite them to the table.
Well, it's a glowing report, and it was a very positive one. It will save money. It will cut down on greenhouse gas emissions. What are the drawbacks? What are the negatives?
Well, Madam Chair, I'll again represent my good friends in local units of government. They are concerned about updating their comprehensive plans sooner than the 10-year cycle calls for, because they're just now finishing them this year. So then we would have to wait 10 years. So we have a little bit of a mismatch. You know, the imperative to act is now, but the comp plans that we only do every 10 years in the metropolitan area are just being finished now. So waiting 10 years is a problem. And though I believe that local units of government in the entire metropolitan area will experience tremendous benefit in terms of foregoing a tremendous amount of infrastructure, new infrastructure that would be needed to support land use as is conceived now, you know, cities still have the immediate task of administering land use planning and zoning changes and the like. So I don't know if there's a way to draw from those, you know, those savings, those costs that we forego and helping in that way. We are looking to, right now, we're looking to the to working with University of Minnesota to help develop the expertise and the range of ideas so that effort isn't so onerous, but also looking to make grants available through the community. Just blanked on it. Livable Communities program. So that's a drawback. You know, and I'm sure the Met Council they've articulated similar concerns. You know, they're coming to the end of a 10-year process, and they would be responsible for collating all of these local land use plans, and going through the process of reviewing and approving them. We're hoping to maybe abbreviate that process so it's not like redoing the whole thing over again. So we have some conversation to have with them.
What other mandates are in here besides?
Well, there's a
requirement for updating the.
Well, certainly MnDOT, you know, needs to consider a reduction in vehicle miles traveled and reduction of greenhouse gases as part of its goals. Some of the policy direction that it takes. We also.
It's part of the comprehensive plan.
Well, this is it for their overarching transportation policy. So
okay.
Some as they develop their policy plan, they need to keep. Kind of keep explicitly in mind reducing vehicle miles traveled and reduction to greenhouse gases. So that's a new policy goal that we give them in the form of direction as they do their planning and develop their proposals for transportation facilities. Also, there's the schools piece, which is a good thing, I think, actually. That'll be a big savings to local school districts. And frankly, that'll bring us into conformance with the way every other state the direction that every other state, or at least takes us out of significant variance that we have with every other state in the lower 48 on siting of schools. We have this minimum acreage footprint requirement. No other states have that. We have the 60% of rehab value threshold that would trigger mandating building a new school rather than allowing rehab to be an option. And then we include consideration of proximity to already in place public investments like parks and other facilities, and they have to consider transportation when they're looking at siting new schools.
So does it increase the footprint for the school from where it is currently? Does it make it larger now? I mean, the total area that's required to surround the school?
Madam Chair, no, it allows that to be reduced. Right now there's a minimum.
Allows it to be reduced.
Yeah. Right now there's a minimum acreage requirement. And it was developed, and you know a little bit more about this. So it was developed many, many years ago. has not been revisited or updated.
The reason I ask is my entire community of Duluth is revamping its entire school system, and from grade school, I mean elementary, middle schools, and high schools, and it's a huge plan,
yeah.
And they're just in the beginning stages of it.
Yeah. Madam Chair, may I follow up?
Yes, you may, Mr. Bailey.
Yeah, I just wanted to be clear on something. This is for new school construction is what it would be. So this would actually be eliminating a requirement and a mandate, frankly, that local governments have right now. So this would be kind of providing more local control. It doesn't say you can't build a school on 50, 60 acres, but if you can figure out a way to do it, and many communities are, you have that option, because right now it's not an option. So it's not about existing schools, but it's about new school construction that we're talking about.
Okay. Questions or comments? Senator Senjo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe to that question, I have a particular school district that the community is debating between a new school or rebuilding onto their or adding on to their existing school. And part of the reason it was suggested they couldn't add onto their existing school was land space. Would this bill, as it's configured right now, allow at least them to consider their existing school from the standpoint of land space?
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair and Senator Senjum, yes.
Okay.
Yes, it would.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Senator Dibble, for getting this conversation started on this. As I listen through, though, I'm assuming there's going to have to be a lot more components put forward to make this happen, because it's having the goals and then getting into reality. And we listened to some of the testimony about development and that it'll be cheaper for infrastructure if we are more dense. And yet then there's just the fact of, you know, the cost of the land itself and the fact that we have a very large urban footprint as it is. And, you know, we've got some areas that are completely developed and looking at those brownfields, those little pockets that we can develop, and they also need some incentives to go into those areas. And then we have the areas around the perimeter of the urban area where they have lots of land, probably a lot cheaper, and probably offsets the cost of some of those utilities that have to be installed. So when a developer wants to go ahead and put together a community, they're looking at those overall costs and where can I make that profit? Is there thinking about things? Are you going to have different strategies in developed areas versus the developing areas? Are we talking about different tax incentives, or how are we going to approach that, or is that something that's for another day? I mean, can you address that, please?
Madam
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dahl, excellent point, and probably speaks to the essence of this bill, and that is that There absolutely is no one-size-fits-all, nor do all of the best ideas reside in my head or even in the legislature, but they really do reside, in local communities and in the Met Council and in the whole array of stakeholders in our metropolitan area and in our state who look at these questions. So you know, we certainly have strategies and ideas that run the gamut to develop in the fully built environment. We also want to continue developing, in the first, second, third tier and beyond suburbs. And it's up to local communities working in conversation with constituents and the business community, as well as the Met Council, to figure out what makes sense, through their comprehensive planning process. We do look to the University of Minnesota to help, kind of create a clearinghouse, an array of all kinds of ideas. And the ideas run the gamut, from mixed-use, development, new areas that have an array of housing and use types, employment opportunities, and other accessories and amenities. As well as other kinds of strategies and techniques that communities might undertake to reduce vehicle miles traveled in their own, working with large employers, for example, to develop transportation demand management plans, varying hours of workers, or encouraging more work from home type options. That's where there's a you know, there's a whole huge array. And so to be more prescriptive in a bill like this would probably be wrongheaded, because it would really hinder the creativity that's already out there. So absolutely the last word has not been written, and that's going to come about through the actual planning that takes place. We do establish some overarching policy goals. We want to reduce vehicle miles traveled. We want different forms of land use. We want to reduce carbon dioxide emissions that come from transportation and land use. Those are the policy levers that kind of unleash the kind of creativity that's available to us, that respond to a changing market, frankly, allow us to save a lot of money in infrastructure.
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, is the Met Council then going to be kind of lead agency on directing some of this stuff, or do you have another agency in mind?
Madam Chair,
Senator Dibble,
that's exactly right. The Met Council would, as it is now, their role isn't changed at all.
Thank you.
What about in other communities in greater Minnesota? What would be the lead agency?
Well, Madam Chair, there are no mandates to greater Minnesota. There is an opportunity through the EQB to establish a grant program for those communities that want to take a look at this question and create a different land use map and some zoning changes. That's in Section 3. So they would be working in conjunction with the UQB, but they would, you know, all the technical expertise that would come to the fore through the work of the University of Minnesota would, of course, be available to those communities as well.
Okay. Any further questions or comments? And Senator Dibble?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Council did suggest a little grammatical change on line 3.1. Just to strike the words "establish criteria for distribution of" and replace that with the word "make." So it would be the EQB shall make grants to local units of government. Anything Mr. Fuller says makes sense to me. So I'll make that motion, Madam Chair.
So on Senator Dibble's amendment then, on 3.1, to strike "establish criteria for distribution of" and insert "make." Any discussion? All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I will move Senate File 549 as amended, be recommended pass, and referred to the Committee on Transportation.
Okay.
Madam Chair?
Senator Sanjam.
Madam Chair and Senator Dibble, it might be throughout the bill, but on, for instance, page 8, there's various references to each local government unit must do certain things with respect to their comprehensive plans. Would that be city, county, and township?
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, Senator Sanjam, yes, in the metropolitan area.
Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I just
Senator
Dahl. Senator Dibble, there's in the vehicle miles traveled sections, in Section 6, you refer to a 2005 levels. And then in Section 9, Subdivision 5, you refer to 1990 levels. Is there a particular reason for that difference between 2005 and 1990?
I'll ask my expert to answer your question, if you don't mind.
Mr. Bailey.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl. We just took it right out of what the MCAG process had done. So the recommendation through MCAG, one was 1990 and one was 2005. So that was our rationale, such as it was. But if you have a better suggestion, we're open to it.
Madam Chair, I just thought maybe we should thank you. Whatever level we're choosing, we probably should just choose one level rather than two. And I don't know if one's a better level than another. But since there's just a level of confusion if we have two different standards, you know.
Good, Madam Chair, we're Senator Dahl serves on transportation, and I'm guessing MnDOT and Met Council will become more engaged. We've had some brief conversation about this bill, and I'm guessing we can we'll have a lot of conversation about these very points on our way to transportation.
And it appears that one references metro area and one references statewide.
Yeah.
And it might be easier to reduce in the metro area than statewide.
That certainly is the case, with land use opportunities and corresponding transit, bicycle and pedestrian opportunities in the metropolitan area, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
But it would be appropriate to be taken up in transportation.
Yeah, we can do that.
Right.
Any further questions or comments? Then Senator Dibble renews his motion that Senate File 549 is amended, be recommended to pass, and referred to the Committee on Transportation. All those in favor, please signify by stating aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Nice work. Next, I would like to direct your attention to a bill in your packet that is Senate File 657, which is a bill that I'm co-authoring with Senator Dibble. And it's really just a placeholder. So we're not going to go through it at this time. But in view, no, Mr. Galan, I am going to ask you to give a report. In view of the fact that the President is signing the stimulus package today and that we need to be primed to take advantage of that, it's uncertain exactly what role the state will have in the direction of weatherization funds or the energy funds. But we want to be sure that we are ready. The Office of Energy Security has been monitoring this, and they have been meeting and to make recommendations. And so I would like an update at this time from Bill Glahn and Janet Straff.
Madam Chair, Senator, staff, thanks for inviting us this afternoon. Yes, indeed, we have been monitoring the federal stimulus efforts. And I must say, despite the fact that the bill passed both houses of the federal Congress and has been signed by the President, it's still something of a moving target. I'm not sure quite what the appropriate metaphor is, but perhaps the onion. You keep peeling away another layer and discovering something new. And sometimes the discoveries are pleasant, and sometimes they're unpleasant. So it's a 1,000-plus page bill, and although the outlines are taking shape of what might be available for Minnesota in terms of monies that could be spent in the field of energy, it's not quite clear if there are any strings attached or what conditions will be placed on that. In particular, we have yet to hear from the Department of Energy, which is going to weigh in on what formulas will be used to distribute the monies to the states and what rules may apply, what restrictions may apply on how those monies can be used and in what manner and what accounting and record keeping would need to go along with that. But with that extensive caveat there, we do have at least a feel for some of the areas in which money will be available and some of the amounts and some of the mechanisms that we think are likely to be used for delivering that money to Minnesota, and some preliminary thoughts we have on how we might then go and move it onward toward service providers and ultimately the public with the goal of creating jobs and putting people back to work and stimulating the economy. So I'm going to take at the very great danger, since I haven't tried this before, I'm going to take a first cut at describing what we think is going on, except in one area, because there's an entirely new program which has been funded. It had been called this block grant program that had been previously authorized by Congress but had not been funds had not been appropriated for it. We think that this latest stimulus bill accomplished that, and we would have an entirely new program, which is good in that more monies will be available than had otherwise been, but we don't know what the rules of the program are, et cetera, and I'll have Janet speak to that directly. But as far as the areas, home weatherization is going to be one of the areas for which money will be made available through the federal stimulus bill. And, again, all of the numbers that we're going to quote, we've tried to err if we're making a mistake on the low end. So if formulas that provide more to Minnesota are used, and we end up getting more than that, then we'll have good news for you coming back that there's more money available than what we said. So we've tried to, when we're not sure what formula is going to be used for distributing funds, we've picked the formula where Minnesota gets the lesser amount. So we are hoping that any corrections from Janet or I will be on the high side. So it's the short answer is upwards of $200 million, $200 million to be available through, in some form or another, the State Energy Office or related programs in the field of energy efficiency and renewable energy. Home weatherization probably being the largest single one, something on the order of nationwide a $5 billion allotment to help low-income families reduce their energy costs through weatherization. And you'll all be aware that we have an existing program where we serve something on the order of 3,800 to 4,000 homes a year, low-income homes, and low-income here being defined as LIHEAP eligible. And we have an established provider network of our community action agencies and some other nonprofits who provide these services to low-income households. That Minnesota's share of that, we hope, will be at least $120 million. And to give you a sense of the scope of this, that we're doing, as I said, 3,800 to 4,000 homes a year, something in that range. And there's an ultimate goal to try to get to the pace where nationwide we're doing enough of these homes that for Minnesota our share would be something around the order of 35,000, if that's one number I've heard. So, but the point of it is it's about an order of magnitude more than we're spending on this activity today. So we have an existing program. We think it's scalable, but it'll be quite a challenge. I don't want to underestimate the challenge involved here, as I've been telling everybody. Well, now the difficult work begins. It's great news that we have these monies to spend and available to help stimulate our economy and create green jobs, but it's also going to be a lot of work on the part of my staff, particularly Janet, the head of the Energy Office, as well as all of the agencies and all the other providers of these services. So home weatherization, we hope $120 million, and that's the largest single item in it.
Deputy Commissioner Guan, the information that we had been working off of was like $170 million in weatherization funds. What is the current weatherization funds that we receive on an annual basis? Ms. Streff?
Chair and members of the committee, historically, the last several years, we've received about $10 million in U.S. Department of Energy funds.
Wow.
We've also received some through LIHEAP, but about $10 million. So the discrepancy between the $120 million and the $170 million is could be the effect of the changing formula. When it reaches a certain level, I think it was around $250 million, then much more money was sent to the south, southern states. And so we're not sure what the end formula is going to be, whether they will do that or whether they'll correct it somewhat. So I think that probably is the difference between 120 and 170.
In any event, I mean, it's significantly more than we've received on an annual basis.
Yes, it is.
Okay. And are we going to have difficulty utilizing those funds and getting them out in the communities and making it work?
Madam Chair, I think the short answer is yes. You know, it's going to be it's a challenge that we're looking forward to meeting, but when you and I don't base this anything other than my experience as a manager, in that when you scale anything up, whatever the program, whether it's a company or whether it's a government program or whatever you're doing, and you scale it up an order of magnitude, add another zero on the whole thing, and you try to do it all in 18 months, you're going to have some growing pains, and you're going to have some scaling problems. I don't know if it's going – I don't know that we're going to have particular problems. I think there's just going to be a lag from the time that we receive the guidance from the Department of Energy till we can have more energy auditors out on the street doing homes, till we can get crews dispatched to do work in homes. And so I don't think the difficulty is being we have the program in place, we have agencies in place, we have lots of folks who are capable of doing the work. It's just that it may not be in the first 28 days or whatever, the first 90 days. It's going to take time to do it, and we're committed to doing it right. So when you say we're going to have difficulties, maybe we're, at least in our minds, not thinking about which difficulties we're going to have and are on the same page in that. I think it's going to be the difficulty of getting this done quickly, and because we're committed to getting it done right.
What is the federal time frame for spending the money? Mr. F.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're hearing 18 months to 2 years. In the weatherization program, in the first stimulus, the bailout, maybe it's the bailout money, they had already increased weatherization by another doubling of it. So we were anticipating getting $20 million and had already begun to ramp up for that numbers. So we have our community action agencies already hiring people. We've started to ramp up our training as well. We're in close communication with them, as well as the remodeling industry contractors. So we're trying at this point to begin to put the pieces together.
Okay. Senator Dahl and then Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And you asked most of my questions, but as I'm listening to this, I'm pretty concerned because we're used to doing $10 million a year, and now we're going to get 10 times that money, and we had to spend it in 2 years. I see that we're going to, even with our best efforts and best intentions, we're going to have some problems. I'm a little concerned. So hopefully we're going to be able to stay in contact, you know, keep our communications open so that we can make adjustments on the fly as we go here.
Well, and Senator Dahl, remember this bill that's in front of you that Senator Dibble and I have co-authored, it is there specifically for this purpose, is to guide the principles by which this money would be used. And it's there just as a placeholder right now because we are wanting input from the community. We're wanting to continue dialoguing with the department so that we know how we can use the money most effectively throughout Minnesota.
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, I know we weren't planning to get into the specifics of the bill, and there's a number of provisions we have questions and concerns about, but one of the provisions in it that we think or we would like to see continue on being included in the bill is that periodic update to, and has the committee chairs or whether it's the Legislative Energy Commission or what other fora you think are appropriate for us to report back to that. We would like for you to hear sooner rather than later that there are problems, rather than coming back here in February, I guess it would be February of 2010, and tell you, well, it really turned out to be a fiasco. And but we hope that's not the report that we'll be giving you, but we would like to report with you as we progress. And as much as I instinctively resist micromanagement, having the dates in there is particularly useful, and not just for our side, but for your side, that it compels us to get together in some form, whether it's a setting like this or a written report, that we can communicate what progress or lack thereof we're making with this.
Okay, although I won't get too hung up on the language of the bill because we'll come back with a delete all at some point. Okay. And I just wanted to let you know that it has been heard in the other body and is moving in the other body. So for now, we're just laying it on the table while we work on it. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Maybe no need to answer this question now, but it's similar to Senator Dahl, and I think the bill, starts to get to that, and that's, the fact that we're probably going to have to reach way beyond the partners that we're accustomed to working with in the CACs, the community action agencies, because this is orders of magnitude more than we're accustomed accustomed to dealing with, and in order to get out to as many people, as many households that can take advantage of this opportunity, I envision, both we need a ton more auditors, but I also think we just need people out on the street, just walking up and down the street, knocking on doors just to make the community aware, working with other kind of community-based organizations, both to spend the money, but also maximize the tremendous opportunities we have. So, and it sounds like the department is well aware, and it's way too early to even ask those kind of detailed questions. But those are the kinds of things that I'm thinking about. How do we hire, mobilize enough staff? How do we get beyond the partners that we've worked with to date? And reviews are frankly mixed on how effective we're doing the work now through the community action agencies. So we need to really think how we do this as well, because it's in all of our interests to do really, really well, in our mutual interest, because the public's going to be looking very closely at this.
Ms. Streff.
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, we've been constant, it seems, conference calls with the U.S. Department of Energy weatherization staff. They are providing guidance to us very, very soon, and one of those areas that we've talked about is adding additional service providers, and what is DOE going to expect? What are the parameters surrounding that? So they are pretty good with giving us detailed guidance on how the program should be run, and that was one area that they saw. Certainly everybody would need to be adding workers.
Is this weatherization, are the funds available for public buildings also, for public, as opposed to residences?
Madam Chair, is this for weatherization? No, this is a low-income home weatherization. There are specific eligibility requirements that need to be met.
Okay.
Madam Chair, if it pleases the committee, we'll make some more progress here with the programs, because there are some programs that would address that area, but not through this particular weatherization piece of it.
I was just thinking about our asset preservation as we move forward, if there's an opportunity for using some funds to improve energy efficiency of the Capitol and some of the public buildings, too.
Well, Madam Chair, there definitely are funding streams that could be used for those. And this bill talks about lots of public building. So I assume we just want to hear. I know there's the block grant to the State Energy Office, and that's another big increase in money, too. So that allows the potential to craft some more energy programs that aren't as restricted on the income basis as the low-income weatherization program.
Madam Chair, if it pleases the committee, since Senator Anderson brought it up, why don't we cover the block grant part of the program?
Okay.
Certainly. Energy Efficiency and Conservation Block Grant is a program that was passed by Congress in 2007, initially authorized at $2 billion, and had not yet been funded. And the funding that came through the stimulus bill is $2.8 billion nationwide, with an additional $400,000 to be used for competitive grants at some point. We don't have, and I know they're working on the guidance for that as well, and I think they were pretty much finished and probably waiting for the signature, and so we're expecting that in the very near future. So we don't know really to what formula, especially for the large cities and counties that will be working directly with the U.S. Department of Energy. 28% of the funds will be coming through the State Energy Office, and we believe that's going to be $13.3 million is our best estimate at this point. Of that amount, then $7.6 million would be going to the local units of government that are smaller than 35,000 for cities and smaller than 200,000 for counties. The $5.6 million that would remain with our office would be for state energy program activities, which again runs the gamut. We have not decided in our office yet, but it does make sense to me anyway to be looking at how that money would also be working with the local units of government as well.
Okay. Senator Dahl, did you still have a question?
Oh, thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just thinking down these lines about some of the Senator Dibble said, is about getting this right, and I know that's what we all want. And in terms of this communication, I'm assuming that it's also going to go the other direction as well, you know, to the federal level from here. And I'm sure that I'm assuming, again, correct me if I'm wrong or clarify, that we're talking with other states and their experiences where they're at, because, you know, 6 months from now, we see that things aren't going, hopefully they are, but let's say that we're struggling to make this work the right way because of the time frame that we're compressing. Being done a fair amount of construction, I know that, you know, you try to do things too quickly and, you know, you just run into more mistakes. And, you know, it's better off to slow it down a little bit and get it right. And is there going to be an opportunity that, you know, or at least preparing that we can communicate back to the federal government that we need more time? If it takes less than 24, if, you know, 36 months instead of 24, we're still getting it done in a pretty narrow time frame. But are those kind of communications already kind of starting to set those up?
Ms. Streff?
Madam Chair, Senator Dahl, we were pushing for that all along. However, we were trying to get it in two streams, so we didn't get the full amount even in the first year, but it went on. And have been told pretty emphatically that it's, in some respects, they even say September 30th, 2010, and if you haven't used it by then, the money goes back. Now, that does give some time for states and citizens to say, please make it a longer time frame. But at this point, they've been pretty clear that it's to get the money out into the pockets of the Americans.
Right. And were you saying that in the block grant money that the state has discretion over, the $5.6 million, that the state can decide how they're going to use those funds? Or are there parameters for the use of it?
Madam Chair, the parameters that surround those funds are the same for the state energy program. So they're fairly broad, but there are some parameters.
Okay. Would you give us a copy of those parameters?
Certainly.
Provide us that. Okay. Thank you.
Senator?
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Would you tell me again who's responsible for, in the state of Minnesota, for overseeing this block grant and distributing it within the parameters that get defined?
Ms. Streff.
Madam Chair, Senator, for the large cities and counties, cities over 35,000 and counties over 200,000, the block grant is between those entities and the U.S. Department of Energy. They provide plans to the U.S. To DOE, and the funds come down. There is some concern that DOE will not be able to meet the timelines that are required to get that money. And I know they've been talking about are there components that state energy offices could help as far as maybe tracking progress, reporting, and those kinds of things. The other grant for the smaller cities and counties is through our office. So it is going to mean, it could mean a lot of grants for us. And it's a new program, and we're looking at what kind of people we need to get it set up and get it monitored so that it works well.
Okay. Anything further?
Madam Chair, a couple of things. One, I would recommend to the committee an article that was in the Wall Street Journal on Friday, if you didn't get to take a look at it. It had a front page article about the stimulus, and it focused particularly on the monies that would flow through the Department of Energy, some $40 billion, which exceeds the annual budget for the entire agency. And it had, as an example, one of the companies here in Minnesota, Sage Electronics out of Faribault, as an example of a company struggling with some of these issues. They're trying to get a loan guarantee through the Department of Energy. Talked about the struggles that the states are likely to have in this field as well. They talked about Massachusetts as an example. And they, like us, are some one of the states that have a more advanced weatherization program and a long-established one. So imagine the states that aren't as far along as we are. But I hear what you're saying, Senator Dahl. You know, we have already an effort unrelated to this to work together with the folks in Wisconsin who have, I believe, a probably even larger weatherization program than we have. And exactly what you were saying, learning together through as we go this process and a lot of others. I do have one other area I wanted to highlight was the State Energy Office itself, which, and again, I'll ask Janet or Ms. Treff to clarify, but we've been getting something on the order of under $1 million a year to fund the State Energy Office. And through the state, through the federal stimulus monies, we'll be getting something more like $55 million. Now, that's where a lot of these monies are going to come from for these other purposes that we talked about earlier. And we have example.
Excuse me a minute, because we have a discrepancy there too, because we had heard that it was like 66 or closer to $67 million. Is that also as a result of the formula that you're questioning,
Madam Chair? No, that would be a different formula. So, as we've said, these are our best estimates based on what we've received previously. I'm not sure where your number is from, whether it's the NCSL.
I believe it is, yes. Uh-huh.
So, Madam Chair, my understanding, we came up with our estimate just applying the formulas that we've gotten money through in the past, figuring that was
okay.
And if there are other formulas or they've tweaked the formula to get us more, then great. But we wanted to, when we put numbers out in the public, want to err on the low side if there's any question about what the number is going to be. So, but still, you compare $55 million or $67 million, whatever the figure ends up being, to something less than a million, it's quite a difference. And if I would characterize what we've been using those monies for is just the maintenance of the State Energy Office. We have functions that we have to discharge as the State Energy Office for Minnesota and staffing of it and the Energy Information Center, stuff like that. But we also have programs that we've been running through the State Energy Office, such as the solar PV rebates and a lot of other rebates for renewable energy technologies that we plan on at least a portion of these funds using to give grants and rebates and fund loan programs, et cetera, through mechanisms, grant programs, loan programs that we've already used where we've gotten monies from state appropriations or other individual Department of Energy grants or other sources. So we've had programs in place that we've used in the recent past, and we've so we have mechanisms for reviewing grant applications, for reviewing contracts, for reviewing all the paperwork that goes along with it to try to make sure that we are tracking where the money goes, to whom it goes, that it's put to productive use, et cetera, et cetera. And we expect there'll be tracking requirements in whatever legislation ends up coming out of this body, as well as whatever requirements the Department of Energy will place on us, because I'm sure they'll want to know the same things that I want to know, and I'm sure you want to know how many dollars we spent, who got it, how much energy was saved, or in the case of renewable energy, how much energy was produced from it, and how many jobs were created, and what kind of jobs they were. So just to give you the quick, I think we lost that opportunity some time ago, but to give you the overview of what we're expecting from the stimulus and give you just the quickest oversight on where we think the money is going to go and what we're going to be doing with it. And appreciate the opportunity to work with you to Janet has one more. I forgot about the appliances. Yeah. Sorry, Janet.
Oh, Ms. Streff?
Oh, Madam Chair, Director DeLon. I only say this because we did find that it will be flowing through our office, and it's something that truly can reach all of us. In that, $300 million nationally was set aside to provide consumers with rebates to buy energy efficient appliances, so that we can get those refrigerators out of the garages and get new ones in there and lower our energy bills that way. This program, along with others, I think we will be looking at working closely with our utility partners to either strengthen the rebates they have. They already have some pretty good marketing programs. So that's one area that we're going to be looking closely at. But just on a very population percentage based, we are in the neighborhood of $5 million for appliance rebates for Minnesota.
No. Okay. Well, thank you for your report, and we'll be staying in touch and working together. I'm sorry, Senator Dibble.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, I wanted to get back to this $55 or $67 million to run the office. It's not going to take.
No.
It's not going to take $55 or $67 million to run. I mean, we're going to use that money for other things, right?
Rebates, grant. Madam Chair, Senator, as much as I would like to, have. I wouldn't even make a joke here, because as much as I'd like to have those funds to run the office, it'll be for grants and rebates and loans.
That's what I thought I heard, but
other mechanisms. I don't think we're going to be using significantly more than what we have been using to run the office. We may come back to you and ask for some additional positions, but we'll see as we go through this process what our requirements will be.
Oh, Madam Chair, just on that
Senator
point,
Anderson.
We've been talking about this, too, in the Budget Committee, and we certainly will, as much as we're able to have enough detail and to work out a plan, we'll try to put it in our budget, how that money will be spent. And it certainly will require some at least temporary staff added to the agency, added to the office. But, yeah, not $60 million worth. Right. So hopefully we can make use of as much of this money as possible out the door to help Minnesotans, but it's going to take some people to make that happen. So we're going to be working on this in the Budget Committee as well in as much detail as we're able to as we move forward.
But we are interested in your policy recommendations in terms of how that money is funneled.
Yes.
Thank you. And we'll be working with Senator Anderson's committee also. And now I'm going to turn the meeting over to Senator Dahl while I introduce a couple bills.
Senator Pretner-Solny, do we want to hear Senate File 656 first? The appliance standards bill?
Mr. Chair, we can do that.
Okay.
Both of these bills I'm bringing forward, Mr. Chair, as recommendations that came out of CMK group. And 656... actually, Assistant Commissioners Glahn and Thornton presented a report before the committee last Thursday illustrating the progress that we have been making toward reaching the carbon reduction goals of the Next Generation Energy Act of 2007. And one of the recommendations of their report was to consider the adoption of appliance standards for certain applications where federal standards do not exist. It is projected by the MK group that Minnesota could reduce emissions statewide by 15.3 million metric tons of carbon dioxide between now and 2025 if we were to adopt standards for certain products that are not covered by national standards or are limited by federal law. The Appliance Standards Awareness Project estimates that if Minnesota enacts a package of cost-effective appliance standards in the next 2 years, Minnesota would save nearly 700 gigawatt hours of electricity, 3.6 billion cubic feet of natural gas due to furnace efficiencies, and $80 million in utility bill savings. This organization estimates that a state standards policy would have a net present value of about $850 million for Minnesota energy consumers. So these are substantial. Appliance energy standards reduce the market cost of energy efficiency improvements by incorporating technological advances into base appliance models, thereby creating economies of scale. This can create substantial energy savings for the consumer. Other states are moving in this direction, adopting state-level standards. One particular area of interest is television standards. The potential for carbon reduction is substantial, and 3M, a Minnesota company, manufactures the film that flat-screen televisions, for flat-screen televisions that make them efficient enough to comply with stricter standards. This bill instructs the Legislative Energy Commission to analyze the adoption of appliance energy standards. It requires that televisions be included in this analysis, as the energy consumption of TVs has been rapidly growing in recent years and represents roughly 10% of residential energy use. According to this bill, the LEC, which the Legislative Energy Commission, which is will be having its first meeting in early March, must consider the effect of the standard on the appliance market, consumer costs, ability to comply, and projected energy savings. And Mr. Chair, I'd like to invite Doug Nelson from 3M to make a short presentation on a product that they have developed to make television sets more efficient.
Okay. Did you mean Doug Stang?
Doug Stang.
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Stang.
Thank you, it's Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. We appreciate the opportunity to be before you today. 3M, as you know, is always on the innovative side, and we are excited about a product that we've had actually in the marketplace for a number of years, but it fits in line with what Senator Solin is trying to accomplish on energy reduction side in relation to TV. So that's what I'm going to focus a little bit my time today on the TV component of energy. Obviously, what's going on nationwide or globally with the focus on global warming, energy costs, residential electrical demand increasing, as well as their costs increasing, a large part of that is due to television energy consumption. And a big driver in that is that consumers are preferring larger TVs. They're preferring more TVs than ever before. It's very common to have more than one TV in a home. And also the consumers are using televisions for longer periods of time. So there's more attention on this, as well as the discussion for more additional regulatory action. You know, I thought this Wall Street Journal ad or newspaper article kind of stated it all, that that giant sucking sound may be your new TV, referring to the amount of energy that the current TVs oftentimes are using and consuming. So obviously worldwide there's more attention on this, more specifically on USA and Europe, and that's primarily because that's where the largest market share is for these TVs. You can see North America, we account for 33% of the sales for these LCD TVs. Western Europe is 25%, and China 16%. And that's where the markets are, and that's where the regulation is being focused. And this map illustrates where things are being done on the regulatory side. The European Union, China have standards in place for energy labels, letting consumers know what energy consumption their TVs use. California is in the process of putting together standards that have to be in place by 2011, in which TVs will have to meet a specific standard to be sold there. USA, we have our own energy guides, but not as strong as what other countries have in place right now. Even retailers have grabbed on to this. I mean, the marketplace is changing, and retailers are realizing that consumers are going to be looking for more energy-efficient TVs as they realize the cost to them on their electrical bills. Walmart's president, as you can see, says he wants to see more flat panel TV assortments saving 30% more energy by 2010. So the retailers are helping drive this. But and again, reiterating a point that Senator Solon already made, televisions account for 10% of energy use in residential homes. I mean, people always assume their refrigerator and their water heaters were the larger user of these of energy, but you can see TVs are surpassing that now and will continue to do so as people buy larger and larger TVs and use it longer periods of time. So again, driving the TV power consumption is more TVs, bigger TVs, and people using their TVs for longer periods of time. And what's pretty interesting is that right now in the U.S., TVs are on an average of 8 hours and 18 minutes a day, which is a pretty pretty staggering amount. But if you consider the amount of gaming that's used on televisions, all the other activity than just watching your traditional TV, it's clearly I mean, people use their TVs more, and as a result, there's more power consumption, and it's going to continue to be a focus. So 3M, in looking at that issue, even before it became more popular in the media and whatnot, we were ahead. We've had a product out in the marketplace, again, for nearly 10 years that addressed two big issues. You have the issue of providing a product for the LCD manufacturers that's cost-effective but doesn't compromise the image quality because people are buying larger TVs, partly because the screens are so much better or brighter, all of those reasons they want those TVs. And what we believe is one of the solutions. There's other things in the marketplace, but we believe the vacuity film for LCD TVs is cost-effective, and it doesn't compromise the image quality on TVs. The average consumer wouldn't know if this is in their TV or not because the TV is still bright. And what the technology is if you think about it, we have a what we call the vacuity DBEF. I was going to put this all on there. It's basically a film, and you add it to the screen as it's being manufactured. And much like if you think about it in terms of a pair of sunglasses, where sunglasses are meant to keep light out, certain light out, this is kind of the same concept but a little bit reverse, that we allow certain light in. We maximize the amount of light that is available. And comparable technologies, 3M, you may, if you're driving on the freeways and see road signs that 3M has put in place, where you used to have lights lighting up the big green road signs, but you see fewer and fewer of those because the technology allows the film on those signs to capture the light that is shining on that from your automobile, and it maximizes that so you don't have to actually provide any additional light. It's similar technology here, is that these films actually capture light and maximize and send more through, where you reduce your energy use by nearly 30%. The range is between 23 to 37%. So it's exciting technology because it's addressing an issue that's out there. And again, the image quality is not reduced because of it. So there's five main manufacturers of LCD TVs out in the marketplace right now, and our product is used in a variety of forms by all of them, but not all TVs have this. This just shows a little bit more of the technology. See, again, there's energy savings. One of the benefits of this technology is, as I said, it's cost-effective. It almost becomes cost-neutral to the manufacturer because as you add the film, you reduce the need for additional light bulbs. You reduce the need for inverters. You reduce the need for power surge. So there's a lot of other things that manufacturers don't have to install, and at the same time, you maintain quality. So this just shows you an example of a 32-inch LCD TV. As you can see, as a normal TV would have three films in, our modification would be two 3M films. So the number of bulbs reduces from 16 to 10, the number of inverters 8 to 5, and as you can see, it goes down. So you're using less energy, and it passes the Energy Star requirement. California has a retailer incentive program as a financial incentive to purchase these as well. So it is a really powerful story, and even illustrated a little more in real terms. In 2007, there were 19 million LCD televisions sold in the USA, and if all of those had used reflective film, the potential energy savings, as you can see, would be 3 billion kilowatt hours. It's equal to powering 260,000 households or taking 350,000 cars off the road in terms of CO2 reduction. So that's just in 1 year. If you accumulate that over the next, between now and 2011, you can see as this business continues to grow, it is a growing business right now. It's $23 billion a year, and it continues to grow. So it's not slowing down. So over that period, you can see it's equivalent of powering 5 million households or taking 6 million cars off the road. So the impact is significant just by using this film. Now, I mentioned there's other options for manufacturers, and some choose to do other things. You can, you know, they can choose to eliminate the number of light bulbs, or there's different methods. But overall, this still appears to be the one that the quality is not, again, individuals wouldn't know the difference from what they were watching. And actually, in some respects, our screen is even clearer. And had we had the space and means, we would have transferred our big TVs in side by side to actually illustrate clearly how bright our Vacuity film is in a TV, and how you would actually probably guess the less bright TV was the one with our film, but actually the one with it, the brighter one is our film. So we're excited about it. 3M is very engaged in the renewable energy arena, and we'll continue to be, and we're excited about what California has put in place, because we think it's good for the consumers as well. A lot of individuals don't realize how much power their TVs are consuming and don't ask the right questions when they're purchasing a TV, and don't know how to rely on the Energy Star ratings to help guide them. So we think this is in line with what other countries are doing, as well as what's going to happen in the U.S. So we appreciate the opportunity to share our story with you, and if you have questions, we'd be more than happy to take them.
Thank you, Mr. Stang. I guess I had just a couple real quick ones. I noticed that I looked at some power usage ratings in terms of dollars per year on different TV sets recently, and I mean there was a wide range just even looking at similar size sets and, you know, types of models depending on the manufacturer. Is there, I mean, different technologies available besides the film to be able to reduce this?
Like I said, Mr. Chair, members, what our understanding is that what there's different manufacturers of the film that may or may not be as effective as 3M's. As I said, some companies choose, you know, maybe the placement of the light bulbs, maybe it's fewer light bulbs. There's things that they can do, but overall, if you're trying to protect quality, we think our product is far above the other alternatives that are out there.
And the other thing is computer monitors. I'm assuming that's the same thing then, because everybody's going to bigger and bigger monitors as well, and those are usually on a long time.
Yes, actually, Mr. Chair, the state included in their specs an RFP they issued at the beginning of 2007, a requirement for additional energy savings for notebook computers and lab or monitors that the state purchases. We have essentially the same technology that's we use in TVs can be used in monitors, where you can reduce energy use, and it's a simple you put the film on and essentially you can eliminate just a couple light bulbs, and again the cost savings from the additional cost of putting in the screen or that film, you save, you know, what you don't save in less bulbs or the cost of those items, but you save in energy savings in a very short amount of time. So we are we have that same product for laptops and monitors as well. Excellent. And the state is moving forward in their specs.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and guest here, there's backlit televisions or rear projection, there's LCDs, and then there's plasma. Is the material used on all three?
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, no. This technology is for LCDs, but right now I believe the LCDs account for nearly 85% of the sales. So you're dealing with the bulk of what's being purchased right now, and the trend is more and more people are purchasing LCDs. So I don't know. I'm not an expert in this area, so I don't know if – I know we don't have the technology, and I don't know if you're able to do the same thing in a plasma screen with the way it's – and the rear projection, the way they're designed, if you're able to do this.
Senator Carlson.
And Mr. Chair, it seems to me the like a plasma screen is probably 2 to 4 times the power that it takes. Can you confirm that? I think that's correct.
Mr. Stang.
Mr. Chair, Senator Carlson, I don't have the specific information, but I do believe they use more power, but I don't know what the amount is versus LCD.
Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Stang, so if we had television energy use appliance standards in Minnesota, like what the California law that you referenced, that would be good for 3M's business, I take it. That would not hurt you. That would help you, 3M.
Mr. Stang.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, as I said, there's alternatives in the marketplace that businesses, the manufacturers could turn to, but obviously we have a product that some currently use, so we would believe it would expand. The other positive part is this material actually is manufactured in the United States. We manufacture it down in Alabama. We think overall it's positive, and plus, as I said, 3M is investing more and has done a lot in the renewable energy in the whole. We've been very engaged in that marketplace already, and we see that as a growth area for us moving forward. We're involved in, for members of this committee, some of our technologies used in wind, solar, energy. We're very involved in all of those businesses.
Mr. Chair, you know,
Senator Anderson,
when I read the bill, Senator Prentner-Solon, I want to thank you for bringing this forward, but I have a question. Maybe we should just jump ahead and try to adopt the standards. That's my only question. I'm really glad you're dealing with this issue, but maybe we should just try to adopt the standards. And I'm thinking about, I don't know how many other states have done that yet, and if you have really, if there's a reason why you think we should have this studied more before we move forward. Because, I mean, I've been thinking about this for a few years, and I've never pushed it, and I'm really glad you are. Yeah. But I was thinking about the money, and if we were to authorize the process for the agency to develop rules on this, now would be the perfect time to do that because we have a bunch of one-time money, and they could. It's a one-time job that the agency could do is really do the work that would be required to establish these standards for Minnesota.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Anderson, that is a possibility. At the time that we drafted the bill, we were thinking that this is something that the LEC is meant to take on, and we were trying to cut down on the cost, of course, to the state. I'm not sure, I think there's still some work to be done on identifying the standards to meet and things like that. So,
Senator Anderson.
I appreciate that, and you have some other witnesses, right, that are going to talk about this. So let me just throw one other question out there, and I don't know if this is something for one of them, but I'm curious about the whole the standby power issue, too, and I don't know if appliance standards are coming that require TVs and computers and all those other appliances to stop drawing power when they're turned off, because it seems like that should be part of appliance standards too. Because,
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I agree. It is, we're not just looking at television standards. Mm-hmm. This is appliance standards, and so it's broader than just television. But I brought Mr. Stang here because I wanted to show you there are opportunities here in Minnesota.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, it would bring up maybe our other testifiers then. Would it be Carl Nelson you want next, Senator Prentner?
Carl Nelson and Gary Connett, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Mr. Nelson, Mr. Connett, welcome to the committee. Whoever wants to start first is fine. Just to introduce yourself to the committee. And
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Carl Nelson. I'm with the Center for Energy and Environment. Mm-hmm. We are a nonprofit organization working on carbon reduction solutions, and we focus primarily on energy efficiency through research, implementation, and financing of energy efficiency programs. So, for example, we have a lighting program that we implement with Xcel and some other utilities that has served this year about 800 businesses in the state, and we've saved about 10 megawatt, just under 10 megawatts of demand this year for that program. So with regards to the current bill, I just wanted to provide a little bit of context and talk about some of the other states that are doing this. So For starters, there are federal appliance standards, and starting in 1987, they were implemented. And the most recent change to that was in 2007. They keep broadening, both tightening the standards and also broadening the scope of them. So the state standards generally apply to those appliances that fall through the cracks on the federal standards or those which the federal standards are not tight enough. And actually, the whole appliance standards started in the states in California in the 70s, and it took a little over 10 years or nearly 10 years before that was adopted at the federal level. So states are generally the leaders in adopting these appliance standards, and then that has resulted in federal standards being implemented. So right now, the federal standards have resulted in quite a bit of energy being saved. The American Council on an Energy Efficient Economy estimates that current standards will result in 2020 in about $200 billion of energy savings over the life of those standards versus what would have happened without the standards. Where the gaps are, besides televisions, are in some commercial and some residential technologies, including water dispensers, where you have those water dispensers where you can get hot or cold water from them, so they're using energy. There is no federal standard for that. Commercial hot food holding cabinets, compact audio products, DVD players, furnaces, and furnace fans. And actually, there's a large opportunity within furnaces. The current federal standard, which will be implemented in 2015, it's scheduled to be implemented in 2015, calls for an 80% efficient furnace. Most furnaces, 99% of furnaces being sold today, are already 80% efficient. That's an area where Minnesota could really benefit by having a higher standard than the current federal standard. Furnace fans as well, there's a lot of potential for saving electricity in the furnace through more efficient furnace fan standards. Hot tubs, residential pool pumps, and then, of course, televisions. The other states that have implemented stricter standards than the federal standards include Arizona, as was mentioned, California, Connecticut, Maryland, Nevada, New Hampshire, Oregon, Rhode Island, and Washington. Many of these states have started something called the Multi-State Appliance Standards Collaborative, which kind of coordinates efforts among states that have adopted these stricter standards. So there is a high degree of collaboration among the implementation of those standards with those states. And with that, that's all that I wanted to bring to the attention of the committee. We do support this bill and think it could result in some incremental energy savings in the state of Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Nelson. Mr. Connett?
Mr. Chair and members, Gary Connett. I'm a director of demand side management for Great River Energy up in Maple Grove, Minnesota. And I've handed out two handouts earlier today. One is my slides, and it should be just a one page with six slides on it. The other handout is actually a memo from President Obama. It didn't come to me. It went to the Department of Energy on February 11th, just last week. So those are my two handouts, if you will. I want to just speak briefly to Energy Star. I want to speak briefly to the state standards that Carl mentioned, and then speak briefly to that memo that I handed out, and then lastly, just some thoughts on all this. If you found that handout, I wanted to just quickly go over Energy Star program. And actually, Energy Star program really started back in 1975 or thereabouts. And it was really came from California, because California was leading the charge on energy efficiency standards. And so California had set standards for a lot of appliances that eventually were adopted by the federal government, the Department of Energy, and it became Energy Star. And that was way back in 1975 or thereabouts. I've listed all the appliances and different things that Energy Star currently has a standard for, and there's a lot of them. And those are things that are sold throughout the state of Minnesota as well. Appliances, water heaters, heating and cooling equipment, home electronics, lighting, and some commercial products as well. So that'll give you a list of what's already under a sort of a federal standard, if you will. And as Mr. Nelson said, there's some gaps. There's some things, particularly on the commercial side, commercial refrigerators, commercial freezers, fryers, those sort of things. They haven't set standards for those on the Energy Star side. Packaged terminal air conditioners, ceiling fans, ceiling light kits, those sort of things. And so there's some things that they still have yet to go. But that's the list of Energy Star qualified products. What are some states doing? And I've taken a look at three states, if you will. And the first one is California, and my slide says, well, they're the ones that pioneered tough standards for nearly every appliance, and most of those have been adopted by the federal government. And they're currently drafting rules for televisions, as we heard, and that's supposed to be done by mid-2009, and it'll take effect in 2011. And actually, it's a two-tier, if you will, in terms of it. It starts out in 2011 and then becomes more demanding in 2012 or thereabouts. There was a question about the efficiency of flat-screen televisions. An LCD television takes about 50% more energy than the old tube television that we're all so familiar with. A plasma television takes about 300 times more energy than the old tube television that we're familiar with. And I guess the good news is there aren't that many plasma televisions being sold. And so that there's some good news there. And my theory on these big televisions is that it's an aging population, and we need to have these big screens so we can see them. And by the way, we all live in bigger houses today, so you need a bigger television for the big house you have. So we see it all the time. But interestingly, there's California is a little concerned about a gray market developing, and that is if I can't buy the television I want, I'm going to buy it on the internet, and I'll get it one way or another. So there's always that opportunity, or that gray market, if you will allow someone to bypass the standards and get the product that they're looking for. Interesting that refrigerators and air conditioning manufacturers, they've grown up with standards, and they know how to work with standards, and they've developed some pretty efficient equipment. It's a new wrinkle for the television industry, and they're concerned with it, but they'll come around to it. California, they're expecting to pass this television legislation in mid-2009. New York established appliance standards back in 2005, and they provide standards for certain items that are not covered under the Federal Energy Star program. And so it's kind of similar to what Mr. Nelson mentioned. I wanted to quickly mention Oregon. Oregon provides a tax credit based on the energy saved for different appliances. And so it's a maximum tax credit of 25% of the purchase cost up to a maximum of $1,000 per year per resident. And it's a dollar for dollar against your taxes owed. And so there's a real incentive for citizens in Oregon, to buy energy efficient appliances, because they're going to get a tax incentive for it. And we see some of that happening in other states as well. So those are just kind of a sampling of some of the things going on in different states. President Obama, and it's the memo that I gave to you, and if I remember it right, I think it's on the second page towards the very bottom. I think it's the second to the last paragraph. He addresses the Department of Energy. And really, this was a memorandum that was issued just a week ago to the Department of Energy to instruct them to take all the necessary steps to finalize these new appliance efficiency standards. And by the way, the Department of Energy hasn't been meeting deadlines to set these energy standards. They were given this task in 1975 to establish standards for all these appliances, and they were sued in 2005 for not having completed their work. And so now Obama went down to the Department of Energy just a week ago and sort of kind of kicked them in the butt, if you will, and said, you've got to get these things done. It's been long enough. And so he set some rules for them. I want you to take the standards that have the greatest energy efficiency potential. Start on those first, and then work your way through the list. But I want you to get through this list. It's been long enough. And so good for President Obama. And we're going to see the results of that fairly soon, because some of that has to be done by August already. My last slide is just potential action. And I come from a utility perspective, if you will. Well, one thing you could do is give the federal government and the Department of Energy time to finish their work. They've established quite a list of Energy Star appliances already, and Obama's getting them to finish their work. And so we could give them time to do that, and we might have a pretty good federal standard. My second bullet is to establish an energy efficiency regulation similar to California. Take some of what California has done and adopt it here. By the way, this is California's energy standard. It's pretty lengthy, and it's pretty detailed, but it's out there, and you can read it. Provide tax incentives similar to Oregon. And then my last bullet, this is where I kind of come from a utilities perspective, is develop legislation that encourages or requires removal of old inefficient appliances. And let me just speak briefly to this. We have pretty good appliances in our stores. Go to Best Buy or go to Sears. There's a lot of Energy Star appliances. Where we struggle from a utilities perspective is we can't get customers to change out their old refrigerator. If their old refrigerator is working, they're not going to change it out. And we give away a couple $1 million every year for energy efficient or Energy Star appliances. But I would say nearly 90% of that money goes to new builders, home builders, contractors that are building new homes. And they're putting Energy Star appliances into these new homes, which is a good thing. But I sort of think they might have done that without my rebate dollar. What I want is my rebate dollars to go to those customers that have those old pigs in their house, big air conditioners that are inefficient, refrigerators that are inefficient. And we need to sort of figure out, how can we do that? And a couple of thoughts on that. One is there's a lot of talk about energy auditing and energy auditors. I think there's an opportunity, and I look at some of the legislation here that I had the chance to read. It's Senate file number 657, section subdivision 2 under section 7. It says that we need to train these energy professionals. Section 7. Training must include insulation, air sealing, and mechanical work. Exactly. But I might suggest it should also identify and recommend cost-effective energy efficiency measures and improvements. Don't go in that home and just weatherize and insulate. Go in there and give the customer some suggestions on what they can do to improve their efficiency. We need help on this one. And at the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group, I was on one of their subcommittees, and I suggested that maybe when the house comes up for sale, that's an opportunity for us to get into that house and say, let's check those appliances. I'm looking for the opportunity to get into the house, because I can't get into people's houses and change out their appliances. But when that house comes up for sale, I'm thinking, there's my chance. Is there a possibility that there could be some legislation that says when a house comes up for sale, the appliances have to be inspected, and if they're 10 or 12 years old or older, they have to be replaced? The first question I got from the Minnesota Climate Change Advisory Group was, who's going to pay for it? I said, well, I've got a rebate, and I'll give you a bigger rebate for replacing old refrigerators than I will for buying a new refrigerator for the very first time. But I don't know who pays for it exactly, although I think there's a utility incentive there for us. And so that's our challenge. I think there's a lot of energy-efficient appliances out there, and Obama's going to help us with some more. But I think the other challenge is how do we get those old inefficient appliances out there? And there's two opportunities. One is maybe when that audit's being done. And a second might be when some people are buying a house and they do what's called a home inspection. They have somebody hired that comes out and does a home inspection. I suggest that those home inspectors have to be required to be looking at the appliances and giving that potential home buyer a recommendation. Those appliances should be removed. And by the way, the utility will have a rebate program for you. Those are a couple things we could do. That ends my comments. Free to ask, any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Conant. The other part, I've talked to the realtors, and they don't like those ideas of putting things at the point of sale anymore, especially now with the downturn in the housing market.
Yes.
That's just going to make it more difficult, but we certainly can have that conversation. You also brought up Best Buy, and have they weighed in on any of this stuff in terms of since they're all over the country anyway, and as far as these appliance standards, that it's going to make their job, especially when you talk about the gray market, that they may think they're going to lose business if they have to only sell products that meet these standards, but they could buy them someplace else and evade that legislation?
I haven't spoken directly to Best Buy, but I know some retailers are a little concerned with the television standard and that it's going to affect their sales. I'm not too concerned for them.
Okay. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, I want to ask you, Mr. Conant, do you know how much of a rebate Great River Energy gives for someone who buys a new Energy Star refrigerator?
Yeah, we had a... It's about $50 or thereabouts, but we have a campaign that goes for maybe 12 weeks where that triples for some period of time.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Conant, I'm just going to give you my personal advice, okay? So I had an energy audit this fall, and they did look at the appliances and the furnace and the, I have one of those 15, 20-year-old refrigerators, and I'm a pretty energy-conscious person, right? But I'm also very, very frugal. And I have a hard time. It's $1,000 to get a new, to get a nice new Energy Star refrigerator. And the energy auditor listed out, here's how much it would cost you to replace my 20-year-old boiler or 30 or however. We don't even know how old it is. And here's how much it would cost to replace your refrigerator. And the payback, they jot that down. And, it's a number of years at that price. And $50 just ain't going to do it. I'm not going to do it for $100. And so I think that's a big part of the problem. The rebates are good for those folks who are ready to move forward anyway and are ready to put this in their budget. But for the rest of the universe, they're not going to do it. They're not going to get people to change and make that. That's a big investment for people. And it's a big investment for me. That's why I haven't done it yet. I did the weatherization. I did the insulation. But I need a new refrigerator, I need a new boiler, and then I need a new car, And I have kids going to college soon. I'm just a normal person, That's right?
Absolutely.
I mean, that's how many millions of Minnesotans are in the same exact boat. And by the way, do we have standards for boats? No kidding. I don't want to go there. We got to do more to really get people's attention. And with this money that's coming in, if we do it right, we're going to have how many thousands of energy audits around the state in the next 2 years? Tens of thousands of them. And we're going to be reaching out. If we do it right, we're going to be reaching out to tens of thousands of Minnesotans to talk about how they can save money by cutting energy and clean up the planet at the same time. I mean, this is our chance. This is our time. Let's go.
It's our moment.
I'm getting out of soapbox, but... We need to, we could use some of this money to double, triple, quadruple those rebates and those tax credits, and then we'll see something happen. But I don't think we're going to see anything happen for $50. I'm sorry. I appreciate your passion for what you do, but I don't think that's going to get us there.
Mr. Chair, Senator.
Mr. Conant.
One of the things that I can promise you is that we're going to look at our rebates in terms of staggering the rebates. If it goes into a new home and it's their first refrigerator, we call those almost free riders. They're going to get $50, and they would have bought an Energy Star refrigerator anyway. It's their first refrigerator. But we need to stagger our rebates where if it's a person like yourself that has an old refrigerator, that one's more valuable to us because we're getting out the old one. Interestingly, if we talk to consultants about how we can establish energy efficiency programs, they concern us with the idea that maybe your refrigerator is about a year from dying. Mm-hmm. And so if we give you a $500 rebate, we don't recover that because you were only a year from getting a new refrigerator anyway. And so this is the struggle that we have with consultants that help us advise us in terms of how much rebate can we provide. There's that challenge where well, that refrigerator might have been right on the edge of being a goner. And so we have to kind of balance that. But one of the things we are going to do, and I'll just quit with this one, is we need to stagger our rebates. There's certain refrigerators that are going into new homes that don't need much incentive. And then there's other ones that need more incentive.
Mr. Chair, just
okay.
To follow
we've
up.
Okay, got to be, yeah, I think we're already passed around, but Senator Anderson.
Okay, and yeah, my $300 scratch and dent. I keep praying that year is coming, but it hasn't come yet. It's still hanging in there.
They do.
Can I just ask the other question quickly about, is there anybody who's looking at powering off those appliances and that electronic equipment so that it won't use standby power? Is that in anybody's standards?
Yeah, very much so. It's become really much on the radar. I'm sorry. Very much on the Department of Energy's radar in terms of all these phantom loads, if you will. So I think you're going to see a lot of movement in that area. And we need it. A lot of utilities are expecting that 25% of their electric sales are going to go to electronics in a home. 25%. And you know, sometimes we throw up our hands and say, what can we do with that? Well, the manufacturers are going to have to help us because it's tough to do much about it otherwise.
Mr. Nelson, you wanted to respond?
Just quickly, the standard, Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, the existing standards and some of the state standards do address that issue of the phantom load as well. And the most recent 2007 federal standards, which I don't know exactly when they go into effect, but at some point, one of the things they look at is like cell phone chargers and those AC to DC, and the fact that people leave them plugged in and they're still using juice even when they're not plugged into your cell phone. So that is included in the standards discussion.
We had one more question, I believe, Senator Carlson.
Yes, Mr. Chair and Mr. Connett. First of all, I have an answer for you, Senator Anderson. The way to change appliances is to change standards. So, like today, the HDTV broadcasting is starting in a lot of places, and it's obsoleting a lot of people's televisions. Well, that's one way. But the question I had was, who is the agency and the awarder of the Energy Star? It's not UL, is it? Is there an awarding agency, a testing agency, and are they doing audits?
Mr. Chair. Senator,
it's
the Department of Energy that operates the Energy Star program, and it's sort of self-policed, if you will. The manufacturers get to test their equipment and see that it meets the standard. And so in some ways, there's been some criticism of Energy Star in terms of could there be better or more stringent standards, and I think there could be.
And Mr. Chair and Mr. Connett, just in the last couple of days, I saw a press release about LG refrigerators, and evidently Consumer Reports caught them where they had claimed an Energy Star rating, and they had turned off their ice makers when they did their testing of their refrigerators. And so they're evidently pulling the Energy Star rating on several of their models. But, you know, and I've had some background with UL and with UL certification. And UL used to be very, very specific and hard-nosed about it, and they would do audits. And you did nothing that would jeopardize your UL rating. And I know UL started to do a lot of the self-policing, and so it dropped its real meaning. And I guess if we're going to make sure that Energy Star is going to be a recommended sticker that is going to be on appliances and is going to be relied upon, we're going to have to make sure that we have the right regulation in place that controls that.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I agree 100%. And you know, that takes our Congress to watch over that department very well, because there's been a lot of criticism about Energy Star over the years and some of their lack of keeping those standards at a high level.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you all. I don't think Ms. Streff needs to address the committee. And at this time, I would like to move that Senate File 656 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the floor.
On that motion, is there any discussion? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. I don't mean to sound like, you know, we can all get excited and euphoric and all this, but about a bill like this and energy reductions, but Yeah, I'm listening to about what President Obama's initiatives are in the Department of Energy and getting those folks moving a little bit. Why in the world would a state like Minnesota or any other state want to take this on unilaterally and have then a mishmash of standards across the country and of all things appliances? Why wouldn't we leave this up to the federal government? It was a good idea. That's what I'm struggling with.
Senator Prentner-Solon.
Mr. Chair, and that's, I think, why it's really appropriate to refer it to the LEC rather than to send it to rulemaking at this time, because I think that's one of the things they would do is follow whatever the national standards are and adopt the national standards wherever that's possible and then make recommendations regarding any additional standards that we might see fit.
Thank you, Senator.
On that, Senator Prentner-Solon renews her motion that Senate File 656 be recommended to pass and refer to the floor. Any further discussion? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to hold over the next bill until next week.
Okay. We can hold that next bill over. That would then conclude our business for today. A couple announcements. We will not be having a meeting on Thursday. The next meeting will be on Tuesday, February 24th. Thank you. The meeting is adjourned.